Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another program in our ongoing coverage of the Casey Anthony trial. Joining me in the studio is my wife, Jan. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Simon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our program.
And from Ground Zero, Orlando, Florida, we have journalist and writer for the Orlando magazine, Dave Nackel. Dave, welcome.
Good afternoon, Simon, everyone. I'm going to try and keep my voice today. It's a little bit rusty sounding, but I'm going to try and do the best I can.
I am also very, very happy to welcome a new guest, someone that hasn't been on our program before, Manny Barling. Manny has spent 35 years in the legal world. Manny, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here on a Sunday.
I should point out that Manny and I usually spend our time railing on the food industry and health issues. So this is something new for me. Manny playing the part of lawyer. Woohoo! Fasten your seatbelts, folks. We'll probably all have lawsuits by the end of the program.
Well, rarely do I have an opportunity to get even with anybody for anything, so today's my day.
and of course, no program would be complete without bail bondsman William Cobra Storbs. Cobra, welcome.
Thank you, Simon. Good to be here. Want to know why Dave lost his voice? Was he screaming at the judge or laughing his butt off in the event that transpired this week? That's the only question I have, and I'm glad you got a lawyer because they can tell we lawyered up now, by God. Come on with it.
That's right. I mean, does this mean that we can officially say that this program is now lawyered up?
Yes, it does. Yes,
don't
it does.
Do it on my account.
Okay, due to travel commitments, Denny Griffin can't be with us today. Denny, have a safe trip to New York, and I know that he will be joining us again next week. As always, our chat room is open, and we do welcome everyone to leave their comments and questions in there, but please try and be nice to each other. Okay, on with the program. After almost 3 years of waiting, finally there is some movement with the Casey Anthony case. Last Monday, we saw the jury selection phase begin, but it was hardly the Swiss watch motion that Judge Perry would have liked. 6 long days, and I do mean long days later, he now has 12 candidates that have made the cut so far. Dave, without getting into any specifics yet, does qualifying 2 candidates per day surprise you?
No, that doesn't surprise me at all. On average, you know, but at the same time, remember, there are still strikes that either side can call upon. So we might end up getting 8 in 6 days. So 12 doesn't surprise me at all. I thought it would be actually a little bit more, but of course it's not. I think the judge is moving things along. I think that and starting tomorrow is going to be a little bit different. He said they're going to be playing by his rules.
Okay. Jan, you're not a criminal defense attorney. Were you surprised at only being able to find 12 people in six long, long days of grueling testimony?
Well, I don't know if I was surprised or not, because I wasn't really knowing what I was going to expect. But just listening to what everybody was saying, I expected it to go slow, but that Monday morning was ridiculously slow. So I was really kind of surprised with that one.
All right. Now, we have to ask the legal eagle. Manny, I'm not even going to ask how many trials you have been involved in, how many times you've been involved in jury selection. When you have a serious case, you need to pick your jurors with care. Does the statistic, and I don't want to make it sound like a football game, but, you know, two jurors a day, does that sound reasonable to you?
Well, first of all, let me give you an overall observation. Trials are interesting. They're like construction jobs. They're very hard to get started and slow at the start, and then they move quickly, and they're very hard to wrap up at the end. In construction, you have punch lists, little things that never get finished, and in law, you have paranoia between the judge, who's worried about protecting the record, the prosecutor, who's worried about whether she's got her first full case on, and the defense lawyer worried that if he hasn't said everything he wants to say. So that dynamic always affects the start. But getting back to this, I am always surprised, I'm not shocked, when a case starts as slowly as this. In California and in most federal jurisdictions, the judge tends to control voir dire. In other words, you go, well, you want to ask a question, goes, that's not appropriate in this court, or you'll do this or that to cut you off. In Florida, the rules are a little more liberal, but still the tendency for judges to control situations doesn't change. So perhaps this judge was being more sensitive, shall we say, because of the press. And I believe that Jan's right, and I think it was Jan that said she expected things to change, because at some point, usually over a weekend, the judge goes home, rests a little bit, looks around and says, I'm tired of this. And I bet by now he is tired of whatever little fighting's going on and all the different reasons, no matter what they are, that's caused the case to drag on at the rate that it has. So I'm never surprised in the first day or two. By day three, I'm shocked. And as a trial attorney, the first thing I agonize over is the judge going to let me voir dire these parties, or am I going to get shut up all the time? And so from my standpoint, he sounds like he's being more liberal than most judges.
Cobra, are you surprised with the stats so far?
No, I think things are going to start moving a little quicker, too, because they're going to go over to the sheriff's pool over there, and if you got a driver's license, you, too, could be part of this jury.
That's right.
Well, he already said that he was going to ask the homeless shelter who has driver's license.
Yeah. Ain't that amazing?
Well, I think that's a cynical remark. And by the way, one of the problems in this case that really influences the delays is the constant amount of press. I caught this bit with a juror who was, passed over for cause, who then said, gee, you know, I was intending to write a book. Well, that's in the mind of everybody, and certainly was evidenced by the O.J. Simpson case, where many of us felt that was the primary motive of almost every member of the jury.
Okay, let's talk just a little bit about the jury selection process. Voir Deer or whatever it's called. And actually, this week it looked more like Deer in the Headlights. But you start with, let's say, 200 people, and you initially treat them as a group, and some will be disqualified immediately as being ineligible. Stick your hand up if, you don't have any, whatever the reasons are. And then you take the remaining ones and start to deal with them individually. Now, Manny, I don't know if this is the normal practice for voir dire, but this particular judge decided to bring each one in and question them over hardship issues, either financial or, other hardship issues like caring for family members. Is that the normal process?
Well, let's break it down into two categories. There are cases that nobody has any interest in, and this usually is a hand raiser at the start of trial, and everybody looks around the room, and anyone who clearly doesn't want to be there uses this as an excuse. But frequently in these cases, you're looking at a trial that could go on just an interminable period of time. And so they're concerned that people have financial necessities, a variety of other issues that could impact what happens if the trial goes 5 months or 6 months. That's a tremendous burden on somebody's life. So the judges are always deeply concerned about that in these high-profile cases. But you won't see that in most normal cases.
Okay, so it's not unreasonable for the judge to deal with hardship as the first issue.
Well, no, it is customary, but the question is, when he starts calling him into chambers, that means he's asking a variety of questions that he doesn't want to print it in the press, like, how much have you read about it? Do you know these people? Do you want to write a book? What are your intentions? Do you have motives for being here other than serving the ends of justice? Because there are people who are mini thrill seekers who go, God, I'd really like to be on that jury. I hear people say that to me in everyday life, and I go, are you crazy? But some people seek this out, and he wants to differentiate between people who are serving the system and people who are essentially serving their own interests. And that's really what we're talking about.
Right, but I'm talking specifically about hardship.
Well, that's what we're talking about. It allows him, under the guise of hardship, to do something that's hard for him to do in open court. So when he pulls somebody into chambers, it's because he's got an agenda, and that's the usual agenda, is to ask those questions out of what we call in camera, which is basically Latin for in private. So anytime a judge does that, you ask yourself, what does he want to ask them in private that he doesn't want to ask them in front of a jury? And that's always the question.
Okay. In this particular instance, though, almost none of the jury selection has been done in camera. In fact, it's been done on camera.
So I noticed it's being televised live. Oh. What a disaster. And that'll it just adds an unbelievable amount of time to every case. Why? Because now judges start looking over their shoulder going, oh, my God, people are watching me. Oh, my God, you said this. What am I going to do about that? So it adds a dimension that many judges aren't used to. Here in California, we deal with this issue so often that, judges are so used to having court, this kind of media coverage, Lindsay Lohan, you name them. They're no big deal to us, but in a smaller jurisdiction, it's something they're not accustomed to.
Dave, do you have any comments on how the judge handled the hardship phase?
Oh, I think he was very generous, very liberal. He gave, he cut loose a lot of people that said it would be a hardship. The only thing that I'm concerned with is it seemed like some of those people basically wanted to be on the jury for their own. Well, not that they would do anything wrong in how they rule or how they decide or guilt or innocence, but it seemed like they had an ulterior motive, which was maybe to better themselves after this by writing a book or whatever. And, you know, I just kind of got that opinion on some of them.
And that's constantly a problem.
Yeah, it is. And,
okay.
I mean, how many of them from the O.J. trial wrote books?
Oh,
now, none
okay.
of them, to me, were bestsellers. I mean, I don't know of any, but they were written.
But, you know, that doesn't make them hope any less. That's
no,
the point.
No, it doesn't, no.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, the way this week unfolded was... He went through the hardship phase one-on-one, and, you know, I personally think he was more than fair. You know, anyone that had the slightest potential problem, he excused. And then he moved into phase two. And phase two was also a complex area, a three-stage process. The discussion of how much pre-trial publicity people had been, made aware of. Death penalty qualifications, and then general voir dire. Many is that normal in a criminal case where the death penalty is on the line?
Yes, that's actually usually referred to as a statement of the case. And it occurs in every case, somewhat of a general reading, because one of the questions that tends to follow, and I'm sure he's probably asked, is after hearing that, have you heard anything about the case? Do you know anyone in the case? So he uses it as somewhat of a springboard to ask other questions. So it's traditionally called a statement of the case.
Dave, you and I have discussed this earlier today, and I think yesterday. The juror that managed to get himself disqualified for completely ignoring the rules, in fact, went on his Facebook and published the... rules that the judge had given him about things not to do. Did that amaze you?
Well, I was kind of surprised that somebody would be stupid enough to do that. I mean, this is a very, very serious thing here. You know, and he went on his Facebook and told the world. You know, I mean, that was really a dumb thing to do. Here he expected to write a book out of it, and... you know, he can't even write he can't even write a comic strip now. So.
I know,
really
I thought
stupid.
It was pretty stupid, too.
Yeah, I don't understand why a guy would do that, knowing the serious nature of this crime and everything. It's like the guy who was fined $450. He wanted to get out of it. The guy didn't take this seriously. This is a very serious thing. And it's a duty, I think, as a citizen, it's a civic duty, anyway, to do this.
Okay,
so,
you brought up the subject of the guy with the fine. For listeners that are not, up on the story, it goes like this. Judge says to the juror, okay, we're going to break for lunch. Now, do you understand my admonishments about not discussing this case with anyone, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he says, yes, Your Honor, I certainly do. They reconvene after lunch, and judge is informed that over the lunch break, the juror had sought out a reporter. It wasn't the reporter coming to him. It was the potential juror going to the reporter. The judge basically came unglued and fined him $450. But the gentleman left the courtroom and supposedly was laughing. Oh, it's only $450 to get off this case. I was astounded.
Well, actually, he was approached by Kathy, I believe it was Kathy Bellick after that, and she was trying to ask him something, and he said he didn't want to say nothing. He just wanted to go home. And she asked him, how come you were so willing to talk before, but now you're not? So he wasn't too happy.
Okay, Manny, we have a situation where a person goes to lunch and seeks out a reporter, $450 fine for breaking the court rules. We have this other gentleman who decides that he's not going to break the rules, he's not going to name the actual case that he's involved in, but publishes the whole thing on his Facebook. Do you think he should have been held in contempt?
Well, I think they both should be because they're both willful. And some judges, there's a notorious judge in Los Angeles Federal Court named Manny Real who would put him in jail overnight. So, know your judge, and most lawyers will tell you that there are judges you might be able to get away with that with, but there are more that will probably put you in the slammer. I mean, that's, you know, to describe it as something serious is really a mild understatement.
Well, Judge Perry did tell him that he could have, that he was, could just put him in jail, but he was going to let him slide with this time with just a fine.
Yeah, but as I say, some judges don't let it slide because, and by the way, you have to remember he's got the media watching, so I don't think he's in a rush to put anybody in jail angrily in front of the media, but other judges would. So this judge is going to be probably err on the side of being cautious because he doesn't want to be criticized for being too authoritarian.
Oh, Cobra, do you think that justice was served? One guy gets a $450 fine, the other guy gets a slap on the wrist and told to go away.
Did he leave us again?
Cobra's probably climbed back on his bulldozer.
I'm here. I didn't hear the name Cobra come into it. I was listening, but I didn't hear it.
I heard snoring.
That's what everyone says.
You get a slap on the wrist and go away and mind your own business is the last thing I heard you say.
Okay. Cobra, do you think it's fair that one juror gets fined $450 for blatantly ignoring the judge's rules, while another is just given a slap on the wrist and sent home?
Well, given the two situations, the one upset the judge pretty bad. I mean, it's one thing to not want to be part of the jury, but after he just got done saying, do y'all understand? Now go to lunch, have a good lunch, and don't be talking about nothing. And he busted ass out there and started talking right away. So that was still fresh in the judge's mind. The other one is a little different because it was the timing.
I guess timing is everything. So, fair? I don't see anything fair in the judicial system anymore. Remember that. Nothing fair. It's just how much can you afford?
But it's not anymore. It's always been justice has been far more available for the rich than the poor. It's not just today. I mean,
I wish I'd learned that a long time ago, Manny. I was under the false pretensehood that no matter if you had $2 in your pocket or $200,000 in your pocket, justice was justice, and it was equal, and that bitch is not supposed to be peeking.
Well, I'd like to drink the Kool-Aid you're drinking.
Well, I've been in the judicial system for 30 years, on and off as a bondsman, officer of the court. Just the guys that you represent, getting them out on bond and stuff like that. And for the most part, I would have to say that I believed in the judicial system as being fair and probably one's last chance of some type of fairness. And then when I found myself involved in it, it all changed. I don't believe that anymore. So I was probably drinking Kool-Aid for a long time.
But, you know, there's an old expression that justice is fleeting. And it can be, because there's so many reasons why there is justice in some cases and frequently no justice in other cases, because justice is by itself affected by all the things that go around it. And oftentimes everybody has a different definition of justice. And I always tell the story that my clients will sit down and tell me something, and they'll go, well, this is what I want to do and whatever, and I go, we're going to write it down. They go, what do you mean I'm going to write it down? And I would say, I don't like revisionist history, because when it comes to the end of the case, if this doesn't go the way it goes the way you're suggesting and you don't want to agree with it, I want you to know that you've changed your position. And I got the idea from John Wooden, the famous basketball coach at UCLA, who every year would write down what he thought his team's record would be during the year, so at the end of the year, he didn't make a mistake and believe he had a better year than he thought. And it's very true, because I can't tell you how many times I've looked at my clients and go, yeah, you want to see what you told me 2, 3, 4 years ago when this case started? And it's invariably people change. So that's one of the reasons. So everybody has a different concept of what justice is. Everybody has a different opinion of a case. I know lots of people, including my wife, who still believe that O.J. Simpson was not guilty and that he got ramrodded by a question of jurors and other people who basically predetermined his guilt from the beginning. So
you sound just like the lawyer represented me. I swear to God, I think y'all had a phone conversation just prior to this, because that's exactly, I got led down a primrose path and then go, well, you remember the conversation we had? No, I don't remember that damn conversation. I'm going to jail forever? No, I don't remember that shit. I thought the lawyer was supposed to represent you and, 100%,
well, wait a minute.
All the way.
There's a difference between representing someone and having them change what you all discussed from the very beginning. And since he didn't have it written down, he couldn't call you on your bullshit, frankly. But quite frequently, that's what happens with clients. They just
I thought the objective here was to get your client free and represent your client. You said, Simon, where'd you get this guy from? Palatka?
You weren't discussing my obligations as an attorney. We were discussing what happens when clients change their position all the time and don't want to accept the consequences of what they do. Not every client you represent is guilty, quite frequently, or innocent. Quite frequently, you represent people whose conduct could be considered guilty or a crime, but may not be a crime, or that everybody has a different viewpoint and interpretation of it, because people do disagree about what is a crime in this world. So it's not as simple, black and white.
Okay.
I'm
going to jump in here, because I like both of you. And I class you both as friends.
Thank you, Simon.
Right. So,
thank you. Because I was getting ready to get an airline ticket out to Las Vegas or Los Angeles or where the hell this guy's at. Manny, where you at?
I'm in Los Angeles, and just bring it on.
Hold on, Simon.
Okay. I'm going to ask a very general question, and I want to go round the table on it. I'm a news nut, always have been, probably always will be. that there isn't a major case that I don't know something about. It you know, it's just the way I am. I stay glued to the TV news. I look it up on the internet. I hear things from people I talk to. I get emails all of the time. And quite honestly, I've been shocked this week at the amazing dumbness surrounding the case. I mean, a little girl is murdered. Her mother is the person charged with the crime, and yet no one in the St. Pete area seems to have ever heard of it. Am I missing something? Is it just that I'm strange, or everyone else just lives under rocks?
Have you ever been treated for this, Simon? Yeah, this thing that you have about in the news and stuff. I mean, you know, there are people who specialize in treatment for this illness. You know that.
Okay. Manny, seeing as you seem bound and determined to beat me, I'll start with you. In your years of being involved in high-profile cases, knowing of people involved in high-profile cases, are you amazed at the amazing lack of knowledge shown by potential jurors?
Well, as you well know from a long-running conversation between us, I have strong feelings about the lack of education in our country across the board. And this is, like health, which I rail about frequently, this is not much different than that. Here we have a situation where it's a justice issue. They don't teach law or any form of justice in the schools. They teach a very, very poor, do a poor job at teaching any form of civics, and generally that's so diluted by being politically correct. I mean, I remember I went to a private Catholic school, and of course, morality is always an issue in Catholic school. So I went home one day and said to my father, I didn't know that Christopher Columbus died of arthritis. My father almost fell out of his chair, you know, laughing, said to me, son, he said he died of syphilis, and the Catholic Church doesn't want to say the word syphilis to you because they think you're too young. So, you know, people in this country are so busy coloring history in a way that history doesn't get taught the way it should, and I think that's one of the biggest problems. So if you come from the basic understanding that these people who just receive a poor education in the system, it shouldn't surprise you that they know nothing at this level in their life.
Okay, Dave, I'm going to ask you the same question, and I think I know your answer because we've discussed it before. You talk to people, and you're actually in Orlando, and they don't know anything about the case.
Well, my voice. There are people, a lot of people, who don't pay attention to it. I mean, people recognize me now. I mean, I have a lot of friends, and people on the street, people that know me. A lot of them say, "Well, what's going on with that case? Was she found guilty yet?" I mean, they're not following it. So they know about it, but they're not following it. And basically, it's the same statement. Did they find her guilty yet? So they have this mindset that the girl is automatically guilty, but yet they don't follow the case. So I'm sure that as you move outside of Orlando proper, you know, into the outskirts of Orange County even, and continue going farther, you know, east, west, north, south, you're going to find people who just don't care about it. I would imagine if you went to Putnam County, you'd probably have more people concerned with what happened to Haley Cummings than you do with Casey Anthony. So
well, David,
I think you're going to find...
Dave, how much of this do you think is denial, a combination of people who don't want to admit that happened in their county and those people who are leading a difficult life and don't want to go home every night and turn on the news and see something that's grotesque?
I will say that it's predominantly males who don't know much about it, you know, because they don't have that same, I guess, relationship with a toddler or whatever like a mother has with a child. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I'm not trying to point, you know, a dim picture of fathers or anything like that.
Well,
but,
you think it also may be an issue that the men don't want gossip, and to be able to follow this case at the incredible level that it's been going on requires somebody to have somewhat of an interest in their gossipy type situations.
Well, I'm sure there's some of that. I mean, there's no doubt that people love gossip. So, but I think that people just tired of it, too. Initially, when it came out, everybody was interested in it. And then as it went on and on and on and on, some people just faded away and lost interest. You know, they went back to their jobs, they went back to their lives, and, you know, didn't really care that much. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with following the story, either. It doesn't make anyone odd, but... excuse me. I think that had Judge Perry stayed here in Orange County, he could have sat a jury. But I understand the reason why they had to move outside. But like I said, as the farther away you go, the less and less people are really sucked into this story.
A major reason they had to move from Orlando was none other than my lovely wife, Jan.
Not the major reason.
He's blaming you again, Jan.
He always does.
Yes. No, I mean they did actually cite her in the motion for a change of venue.
Yeah, they did. One of my articles.
Okay. Jan, well, let's talk about a story that's way closer to home. Zachary Pittman. Just for 2 seconds. Right, a guy goes missing in a town, 20 miles from here?
Yeah.
He's been missing for two years.
Almost 2 years.
It's an assumed homicide. No one's ever heard about it. I mean,
people right here.
Right.
Haven't heard about it until we brought it out. But they just couldn't get, I mean, no, there was no publicity at all about it.
Yeah, I guess people are living under rocks. Cobra, do you think people live under rocks these days?
We mean these days. People lived under rocks. In fact, I'm moving a couple rocks out here looking for somebody right now.
Isn't that usual where you find guys who step?
Under rocks? I'll tell you what, you know, sometimes you do. Or in the lawyer's office, that's where you find them. I'm not letting up on Manny now because he's
by the way, I
vodka.
I agree with you. That's one of the first places I look for people. There's two things they don't give up: their grandmothers and their lawyers. So yeah,
that's true.
I tend to agree with you on both counts.
That's true. All right, cool. We're friends again.
Don't worry, it won't last longer than 5 minutes.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, I want to go back to jury selection. We have a death penalty case, and everything I have read, everyone I have talked to is in agreement that jury selection is a very, very crucial part of the process. Obviously, the ideal juror is not, maybe I'll rephrase that.
Yeah, you know, I'm dying to hear this answer.
No, I mean, what the defense wants is not what the prosecution wants. you know, both sides have their idea of their perfect juror, you know, based on a variety of things, you know, demographics being just one of them. When the death penalty is involved, it becomes even more important. Manny, if I was to tell you that Judge Perry is trying to rush this process along, and he's offered as much time as either side wants for pre-trial publicity questions, as much time as they want for death penalty qualification questions, but 30 minutes per side for general voir dire questions, what would you say?
Again, I'd say he's being extraordinarily cautious and concerned about reversible error. One of the things that I find unusual about Florida, because I had a few moments to look at the state of current Florida law and the statutes on voir dire, is that in some instances you can actually challenge a jury 6 months after the juror has been there, and you can challenge him on different grounds depending on how long he's been on the jury pool. So I think that he's bending over backwards, and every day that he's in this case, he is going to ask himself, what am I going to do today that could cause this case to be reversed? Because not only is it embarrassing for judges to be reversed, also limits their ability to be appointed to a higher court, but at the same time, it creates an atmosphere where judges are just worried, and there's nothing worse than a judge who's worried about how people interpret what he does. I mean, to me, that just defeats the purpose of being a judge, because guess what? The word spineless appears shortly after that.
Okay, I'll tell you what. We're going to leap out to the phone lines real quick. We have someone from the 972 area code. What's your name, and what's your question or comment for us?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, this is Charlie. I'm from Texas, and I have followed this case from day one. Earlier, and the reason that I called in is earlier, they made mention that men don't know anything about the case. That's so true. For the most part, on the blog and on Weesh.com, it's mostly women. But we have a lot of people follow it, and I was going to make comment that the reason that we do probably would be because of the outrageous facts in the case, the lies, the grandmother not believing the police and believing the daughter no matter what. And also perhaps another reason why this case like gets so much publicity and others don't is probably it's a lot of based of what's going on in the world, you know, like whenever that earthquake happened in Japan, all of a sudden the media is just covering that. And when nothing else is going on, well then, you know, perhaps these local stories pick up more of the publicity. But it's just a really strange case, and I've watched almost every day. In fact, I don't think I've missed a day. It's a very interesting case, and it's a good education for everybody. In fact, I was even saying on the blog on the first day when Judge Perry was doing the voir dire, and it is voir dire, not voir dire and not voir dire either, that he needs to explain to these potential jurors why we have the court systems that we have. Because of the old English law, if you were back in England when the king was the ruler, they would have chopped her head off the first day. Over, next, you understand?
Well, you can do that in 105 other countries, too.
Exactly. And the whole reason everybody wants to get on a boat and go to America is we have a free country and a jury system where you are supposed to be innocent until found guilty, and that is up to the state to prove that you're guilty, not you prove you're innocent. And there's a difference, though, between the public, what the public's perception is of this girl, and what the court system's perception is. So we hear
And obviously, if you've been following the case, you do have a an idea, a preconceived notion. Is she innocent or guilty?
Well, we know from the facts, unless they've got something up their sleeve, Mr. Mason's made mention of how he loved to have that little card in his pocket to slip out at the last minute and prove that they're all a bunch of liars. Well, I'm waiting to see that card. I'm waiting to see what evidence the defense has that she's innocent. The evidence that the police have produced is just overwhelming. There's just, I cannot imagine. I have tried to think of a thousand different scenarios that might make her innocent or that somebody else was at least involved. Cindy keeps saying she had a number for Zanny, for instance. We have records now. There's a paper trail for everything. There is no Zanny. Sorry. There's
might be able
not.
To help the caller out there a little bit, Simon.
I mean,
Zanny's been debunked for a long time now.
And they admitted it. And I hope Linda Kenny Bodden, I hope she got a release on paper before she said that publicly. Because of that, attorney-client privilege, you know that they told her to say that. Otherwise,
that's what
wouldn't.
I thought, too.
Yeah.
Caller, what would you think if all of a sudden it wasn't Casey who killed the child? What would you think if all of a sudden the struggle match that only three people were in the house, Casey, Kaylee, and Cindy Anthony, and when she started choking her daughter,
mm-hmm.
that the little granddaughter, suffered injuries in that attack so horrific that consequently led to her death a couple of hours or a couple of days later? And how would I say that? Based on the fact that she said nothing for 31 days, but it's believed by me and a few others that all the conversation going on the telephone, while she did not have eye-to-eye contact with her daughter for 31 days,
mm-hmm.
they talked on the telephone every single day for hours.
Right.
We believe that these stories, it's my opinion as an investigator for Mr. Grun, that these stories came out and they were leaked out and let out by Cindy. And Cindy, it's by my belief that she is the one who tried to offer up every single alibi possible, tried to frame our client, Jesse Grun, for the murder, continued to ask questions, knowing full well that she was involved in this thing, and then turned around at the last second and said, "Smells like a dead body in the car." At that time, Casey decided, "She's got me now." So there goes the ball game. But
who did the computer searches? Who did
the computer searches? The computer searches, we believe, was done by Cindy Anthony as a helpmate to cover up the accidental death or murder, however you decide to look at it, and help her daughter out. And she was the one doing all this stuff.
3 months
before
the crime.
Here's the thing. At one point in the whole turn of events, another theory that's out there that hasn't been surfaced yet, and it sounds kind of weird, but be damned if Grandma Cindy is going to get this child. So there's got to be some humane way of getting rid of this child. She didn't want Cindy to have the child, period and simple. And some of those searches and some of those things were done prior to, and some were done after the fact. But most of the testimony that this young girl has given up, I believe, has been at the beckoning of Cindy, who has tried to figure out some way to blame the blame on someone else when all she has to do is look in the mirror.
Well, Cindy is no doubt guilty. She is guilty of certain things. She's guilty of being a bad mother, of not making her daughter own up.
She could be guilty of murder as well, accidental murder. She could accidentally have choked her and this child together and freaked this daughter out.
If that is true, number one, I will eat my hat. Number two, she is the best actor on earth. She deserves an Oscar.
Hope it ain't a big one.
Okay, I want to ask Manny two questions. Would this be your perfect juror that we have on the line?
No, but she would be a typical juror. We saw this with the O.J. Simpson case. And when they asked a juror, did you think O.J. Simpson was guilty, they all said yes, based on what I saw in the news. So that has become an issue in our country. But this is a lady who lives in another state who's not subject to the jury pool and is certainly entitled to express whatever viewpoints she would like. But it's not necessarily good within a jury pool. But I'd like to point something out to all of you. Having been involved in more than my share of celebrity cases and quite frequently a lawyer in them, I would pick up the paper and I would turn on the news and I would fall over laughing what was being reported. And my wife would die laughing if she knew what was going on in the case because none of it was true, even remotely close to what it is. So people sit around daily and they speculate on what could happen, what didn't happen. I hear some interesting theories by both of you, but they are basically theories. And nobody really knows what happened, and no one is ever going to know what happened because frequently what happens in trials is everything but the truth comes out. And what bothers me most about prosecutors are they have all these opinions, but they weren't there either. So they pass their opinions off as if there's some form of gospel, when in reality there are no better guesses than this nice lady is making from a distance in Texas.
But
and
they're
that
based
just
on paper trails.
Unless
the DA is not telling us things.
What's happened is it's based upon the paper trail that you've been permitted to see, written in a way that is most favorable to whoever wrote it. And quite frequently, that information is not what is correct when you get to trial. And please remember, there's two types of evidence, admissible and inadmissible evidence. So just because somebody says they have evidence doesn't mean that it's evidence that will be permitted in a court of law. So one needs to sort all of that out, too. But I'm not disagreeing with your opinions at all. I'm just saying to you that you need to put some of them in bounds in that regard. I think your position's extremely articulate and extremely well taken. But in the end, we're not going to know until we see what's there. Plus, it's the evidence that's presented to the jury, not the evidence that people think they know or the evidence that they've heard or what people speculate about. And frequently, that's not the same as what ends up in a court of law. So ultimately, a jury's going to have to decide those issues based upon what happens in court, not what happens in the newspaper. And it doesn't mean that it's going to change the outcome.
Right.
It just means the evidence will be different.
Right.
And coming back to why men don't do it, I've watched it tangentially until Simon stuck a little burr under my saddle. And a lot of times, you know, men are very busy. They just have so much to do. And for many of us, sometimes, like I deal with a lot of terrible things at work when I'm working, and I deal with a lot of things that are painful to a great many families. And sometimes I come home and my wife says, well, what do you know about this? And I go, you know, honey, I just don't want to think about those things for a while. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you get a man read the evening or watch the evening news where this may be the pivotal story.
Mm-hmm.
After the kind of day he's had, he just really doesn't want to do it. And I think that has a great deal to do with why men have less interest than women. Is some of it's their schedule, and some of it is they're just burned out from stressful and painful events.
You're not a mother either.
Simon. Simon, that's not going by. I was divorced, and I raised two children of my own without the assistance of my wife and was their sole source of survival, got them to school, fed them, cooked for them every night from the time they were 10 years old till they graduated from college and one from law school. So women aren't the only ones who have an interest in children and know how to care for them. And if you want equal rights as a woman, you better give us equal rights as husband and men, because I stand for all the men who won't tolerate that from you.
Well,
I need to interject here. Carla, thank you so much
for joining us.
I need to get to some other calls.
Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, we have someone coming in from the wonderful state of Maine. If we're really lucky, it might be Peter Hyatt.
No, if I'm lucky, what did I come on to here?
Oh,
got a great show going, huh?
Manny, let me introduce you to Peter. Peter is an expert in the art of statement analysis. He reads things and determines the truthfulness of them, much like a lie detector.
Mm. So do you believe in witchcraft too, or what?
Okay, Peter, I do need to warn you, Manny has 35 years of experience as a trial lawyer. You're in trouble.
Oh, don't take no shit. Don't take no shit there, Peter. Get these out. We've already mixed it. Before the show, me and him already mixed it up, so you have go for it.
What is that? What they call lawyer speak all about? I gotta figure that one out.
I've been trying to figure that out too. I want you to know I don't go to lunch with lawyers, and I avoid them as much as I can. So my feelings are generally the same as all of yours. So
all right,
Peter, you've obviously been following the jury selection process this week as it's winding its way slowly and ugly to a conclusion. What are your thoughts?
It has been a week that I would say Copra is right. This was going to be a heck of a show, and it was more of a show than I thought it was going to be. I really thought it was going to be a ho-hum. But there were some fascinating moments in that week. Amazing stuff.
Anything that sticks out in your mind?
Yeah, at one point I had a lunch break, and I was able to watch a little bit on FTV, and I saw, and I hope everyone has their seatbelts on, I saw and heard my own eyes and my own ears Jose Baez asking some pretty good questions, and I was stunned. He asked a couple open-ended questions. He allowed, at first at least, the free editing process of the subject to begin. And from there, it went straight downhill, just straight downhill for him. And I think he bypassed a few people that he probably should have clung to. I think he, as I said last week, he should probably be asking more questions about childhood and looking for some linguistic indicators of abuse, and particularly of those who have been abused, who have not risen above, who have not successfully raised children, for instance. But he seems more interested than anything else in smirking at the camera and getting his, I would say 15 minutes, but it's much longer than that. So it seemed to be the Jose Baez show, which is something that jury experts are, I think, by the whole, missing, in the sense that they're looking for a certain type of element for Casey Anthony, and I think this is the Jose Baez show and not the Casey Anthony show. Having said all that, there was a big twist that came during the week when George and Cindy Anthony were reportedly considering suing Brad Conway or taking some legal steps against him. Brad Conway thinks that Casey Anthony is going to take the stand because there's no other way for them to get the story across about those 31 days other than Casey Anthony. So this has much more drama. I tip my hat to you, to Cobra, to others who said this was going to be quite a show. It really is quite a show.
Okay, Dave, you've been quiet. Do you see Casey taking the stand?
No, I don't. She's just not believable. Everything that comes out of her mouth is a lie. So even if she tells the truth, it's going to be perceived as a lie. I think they're going to do everything they can to keep her off the stand. And not only that, but it opens up a can of worms for her when the state is able to cross examine. I just don't see it.
Jen, I mean, my opinion is it would be a cold day in hell that they put her on the stand.
They'd be making a big mistake. They may as well put her behind the bars and hook her up to the electric chair, injection needle and all, if they do.
Okay, Manny, you and I may have a slightly different point of view. And I base that on sheer, you know, legal precedent rather than anything else. We'd all love to see the woman stand up and tell her story, but there's no legal requirement for her to do so. Do you think they would risk the whole enchilada and put her on the stand?
Well, I think it's way too soon to even consider it. And the reason I say that is that's usually determined by how well the trial goes or how poorly it goes, whether or not they feel that in desperation that's the only alternative they have to succeeding in the case. But the real problem with putting her on the stand, it's not winning or losing the case, because invariably very few defendants are ever believed unless they come with a huge amount of personal credibility, say someone like who's the ex-president of the United States, let's say, although I'm not sure any president has any credibility, but that's another issue. But the reality is that it would endanger the penalty phase, and her testimony could be the difference between her getting basically life or a shorter period of time or the case being labeled something different. For example, how about a negligent homicide, which has already been alluded to at this point? You know, but I think there's a lot, and I'm thinking while we're doing all the different alternatives, but as Cooper pointed out, there's a lot of different explanations. Let's assume that it happened through negligence. Let's assume that it was a negligent homicide for a moment and that nobody could really have the courage to just report it, considering that it would have led to a prosecution anyway, and that they didn't dream that ultimately that prosecution would be far worse than had they admitted to the problem in the first place. So there are lots of different ways a jury can take it. But once she testifies, that determination will be based upon her testimony. And I noticed from reading the background of one of the lawyers, specifically Andrea Lyons, her thing is to keep people from getting the death penalty. And if that's her goal, she's never going to achieve that goal if she permits her to testify. So you need to balance that part of it, too.
Youch.
Why is that a youch, Steve? And it is. It's a mixed bag. Anytime you adopt any kind of trial philosophy, there's a good and there's a bad. It's sort of like watching a fight where you got somebody who's a counterpuncher. So a prosecutor may be a good counterpuncher. So when they expose themselves, now they expose themselves to what can happen to them in cross-examination, they're exposing themselves to what can happen in terms of their philosophy and their personal approach to the case. So the effects are just so far-reaching that, no one's considering it right now. And the answer is always starts with no. They're never, ever, ever, ever going to testify. And then it changes every day with, oh, my God, listen to this testimony getting on the record. Because lawyers tend to sit there and go, oh, that'll never get on the record. We'll block that. The jury will never hear it. But at some point when the judge starts to believe a party is guilty, then they will start, shall we say, controlling the evidence towards the side they feel is guilty or innocent. And once the judge locks in on that, then it's very, very difficult to change the direction of testimony. And at that time, everybody has to start thinking about what's going on the record, what she can say, how it's going to affect the next phase. So you can be sure that decision won't be made for a long time.
Okay, I'm going to change gears very briefly. I want to ask the question, when do you think the trial is going to start? It's set for Tuesday morning. I would say there's zero chance of that. We still don't have enough potential jurors to be sworn in, there's lots and lots of peremptory strikes still left. Dave, what's your guesstimate? When is it actually going to start?
Well, my thought on it was just as the first day of jury selection began, this is going to take longer. They're going to have to start the following week. So, in other words, not Tuesday, but the following Monday. Now, Friday and Saturday, the judge kind of moved things along. And I kind of figured that maybe by Thursday they could get it started. And then all of a sudden, KMG, Channel 6, where Tony Pipitone works, said that they got an inside scoop that it was supposed to begin on Thursday. So we'll see. I mean, no one else is reporting that but Channel 6. But I don't see any reason if they get through this with three more jurors, they get to 15. If you can get more in, great. If not, then I think that I don't think it's going to go any more than Thursday as far as the judge is concerned. That's the day
okay.
he wants to start.
Okay. Jen, do you think it's reasonable Thursday, or do you think it's going to drag on longer?
No, I think it'll go at least by Thursday.
Hmm. Yeah, Cobra.
The one reason I do believe that is because I think that Judge Perry is determined to do it. I mean, he's already said that there was not going to be any delays and it was going to start Tuesday, and he's been forced into no other choice. So I don't think he's going to make sure that it happens.
Cobra, do you
yep.
think Thursday's a good day?
I don't think start anything on a Thursday. I would go to the following Monday for a kickoff. But whatever they said, I would add a week to it. And that's, of course, unless he goes next door to the sheriff's lockup and gets anybody with a driver's license to come over and help him. It's taking them 2 days, or taking them a day to get two. You need some backups. You need some extras in there. I would say if he said Thursday, then make it the following Monday.
Right. Yeah, Peter, what would be your guesstimate?
I had seen the Local 6 article about Thursday because I think they said it can take one day off. So maybe Thursday, maybe Friday. I know that Judge Perry wants to move this along, and he's been very cautious about not appearing to push too hard, but I think it's going to happen pretty soon. I really do. I understand the frustration delays, but I think maybe Thursday, if not Thursday, Friday, the latest.
Okay, Manny, weigh in.
Well, there's some unknowns in here to me. You need to know the judge's policy on handling peremptory challenges and challenges for cause. Usually the way that judges speed the process up is by refusing to grant remove jurors for cause. And if you do that, then it forces the side to use their preemptive challenges, and they only have three each. And they go quickly.
No, no, they have 10 each.
They have 10? That's because they have multiple attorneys and positions. So he's taken them and increased them to compensate for the parties.
Oh, that's interesting to know. Okay.
Yeah, and that happens when you have multiple parties. And by the way, that was probably the subject of a huge argument at some phase of the proceeding, because the prosecutor would have tried to limit their list of peremptory challenges, because that's something very important to them. And so what will happen is they will start rejecting and accepting jurors based upon their concept of what the other side's going to do. So it gets to be a kind of an interesting little dance. But once that dance starts quickly, it ends quickly. And so at some point here, the judge is going to take that dance, and he's going to use it as a way to limit everybody's time. So I can tell you right now that if you look at the way this case is going, and you look at the timing of everything that's going on in this case, then what you're looking at is a situation where he's going to start everything on Monday. Now, by the start of trial, the question is that when they start oral argument, or is that when they call witnesses? He may well do oral argument on a Friday, but he will not start calling a witness on a Friday because he doesn't want that first witness to be stopped by the weekend before cross-examination or during some pivotal phase. And every decent lawyer, certainly my favorite trick, knowing what the Friday day was going to be like and who was on the stand, always had a set of key questions. And what I would do is I would drag on the afternoon session, if I were cross-examining, till there were like 5, 8, 10 minutes before the end of the day. Then I would ask my question like, did you really do this or that? And And I knew it was a question they couldn't avoid, and the answer was horrible for them. When they gave the answer, I go, Your Honor, I don't want to start a new section right now because it's going to be at an hour. I think we should adjourn for the weekend. And you try to leave the jury tainted with a statement for the entire weekend before the other side can rehabilitate or do rehab. So this Fridays bring in lots of strategies, and judges who don't feel like dealing with everybody's strategy on a Friday will have a tendency to start witnesses on a Monday. And
what
also,
do you think he might postpone it until Monday?
It might for those reasons, not knowing how he handles the other items. And he might say, gentlemen, we've had a long week. I'm going to give you Friday to prepare for witnesses and whatever are your opening statements, because maybe opening statements are going to go so long they go longer than a day with all these lawyers, and he wants the jury to hear them with some continuity. Continuity has a great deal to do with how you manage your Fridays in a court system. And he may be gracious and give the lawyers the weekend to be better prepared and rested up, with the caveat, usually sidebar, I'm giving you Friday to get your shit together, and you better be here on Monday, and you better prepare, in this case, better move, because I won't give you another Friday if you jerk my chain. You know, that kind of man-to-man talk about how his court is run? And he might have already said that to them in a pretrial meeting in his courtroom. So she should say in his chambers. So I think all those factors come into play. But at the same time, I really believe that Cobra's right. Judges don't rush to do anything on a Friday. And that's your position, right, Cobra? See, he's asleep again.
He's out with his bulldozer.
I'm over here listening to you.
Okay.
Well, I just wanted your opinion. Do you feel differently about that?
Run part of that back to me one real quick.
Well, the judges have, in your experience, judges have a predisposition to not do too much work on Friday and let it slide if they can. There's some reason they don't like to start stuff on Friday, right? Isn't that your experience?
Well, it leaves it out there hanging, but I think so much for the judge. It would be more for the defense counsel or the prosecution to either tame them up, get them ready for the weekend, and then call a shot. I would not, like I said, I wouldn't want the thing to start on a Thursday or end on a sour note on a Friday. I want to leave something popping fresh in there, because what we're going to do is, and I've investigated behind the scenes many, many times, and first thing that the defense is going to call me and say, listen, we heard this late Friday. You got till Monday, 8:30. To find out if there's any truth to this and where they're going with it. And so it's a scramble at that point. So a smart lawyer will not bring that up. It's not so much the judge. The judge is like, let's just go ahead and get this shit done. You guys run it how you want. He's just more or less the referee to make sure nobody gets out of line. But as far as the defense or the prosecution goes, they're going to want to save any bomb busters and not give the other side those extra couple of days to go and dig up that information or calm down it or whatever they want to do. But I think it lies more with the lawyers than it does with the judge.
And you really think judges see themselves as just referees? Gosh, I wish
pretty
I
much.
Had, wish I had
pretty
some
much.
Of those judges.
You want some more of my Kool-Aid? Peter, get him.
Yeah, I
get
do.
Get him, Peter. Get his ass.
My experience is you can't keep judges out of things.
Get him,
Peter. I have to ask you, I know your expertise is more in the written word, but you must have given some thought to this entire issue. My wife likes to watch one of the soap operas, and I've noticed that Friday's program always ends with a cliffhanger. Is that the way you would do it if you were running a trial?
Well, I've seen it both ways. I've seen judges that were absolute referees who sometimes would even drift off to sleep, and at other times that I've never been part of a high profile case like this though. And I think how I would do it, and in terms of that natural thinking of not letting too much be left off over the weekend, I don't see it this way. I think, and this is just a guess from listening to Judge Perry, is that he is going to move this forward, and I think he's just about run out of patience with Baez and his love of the camera. So I think he's going to push it on.
I agree. I concur. I think he's going to start it as soon as he can.
Dave, you must have more to say than just that.
Well, I mean, he's done everything he possibly can to keep this trial on time, on schedule. Now, he did move it back one day because of jury selection. He said that'll give you a chance to come back to Orlando and gather up all your thoughts and papers and everything, and we'll come here Tuesday morning and start the trial. So he was basically saying that I'm not going to postpone this any longer. We're not going to give the defense any more timeouts or anything. He's a pretty much a stickler when it comes to schedules. So, and somebody had mentioned also in the chat that there's also Saturday. So it's not like, he's going to go half a day on Saturday. So if he starts it Thursday morning, you've got 2.5 days already in before the following Monday. So I think that's enough time to get, things started. So Monday, and I agree that with Manny that, hopefully the defense then could leave the jury with something over the weekend to think about, except that they're only going to have one day off, Sunday. So I don't know how much time they'd have to really think things over.
Yeah, I wasn't aware they were going to work on Saturdays. I missed that.
Yeah, well, I figured that that's one of the things you missed.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll tell you what, we have a busy switchboard here. Let's go out to the potato capital of the world, Idaho. Someone calling in from the 208 area code. What's your name and what's your question or comment for us?
My name is Peggy, and I'm loving your program today because a lot of things were very confusing. Watched most of the jury selection, and I was curious if Manny could maybe tell us about, I didn't understand the striking of the African-American woman. There were challenges by the prosecution, and the defense wanted to keep her, and they asked if the prosecution wanted to strike her. They said yes, and then the defense protested, and they got to keep her. That whole situation just was kind of confusing to me. Was wondering if maybe you could shine some light on it.
I'm sure we can try to do that. I think everyone's confused about that particular go-round. Did you actually watch that?
No, I was.
I did.
No, he was asking me. I was actually preparing for our show, and I missed that. But was there any kind of discussion in front of the viewing audience about cause? Because usually when you have that kind of disagreement, there's some issue or cause that the judge is not sharing with the viewers or listeners because it might embarrass the lady or some other reason. So frequently these arguments about cause are done out of everybody's ear and eyesight. So as a result, less people know what the reasons are. And I must tell you today, I am troubled by them. And when I'm involved in a case, I'm troubled by the fact that the judge will not allow those issues to be heard by everybody because what you have is a situation like this. First of all, you go back to your client and try to explain what the judge has just said privately in chambers that you don't agree with. So I find that it's much easier as a lawyer to have your clients hear everything so you don't have to explain it. And in this particular case, this is a situation where the judge is elected to do something without explaining to everybody why he's there or what his motivations are, and it won't come out until the end of the trial when this information's released. And one of the reasons is they don't want to prejudice the jury having them hear whatever reason it is that they feel that this lady should not have been on the jury.
Oh, okay. Dave, you watched that segment, and were you as confused as I was? You know, but there's a preempt strike, and the judge strikes it down. And I thought, well, preempt strike?
It's peremptory strike, by the way.
Right.
Peremptory, yeah. Well, yeah, I thought I heard him say that. I thought I heard Prosecutor Ashton say he wanted to use one of his peremptory strikes, and the judge did turn him down. But then somebody said, no, I don't think it was one of those. It was a cause strike. And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, it sounded like a peremptory to me. But,
Simon?
Maybe somebody really knows out there. I didn't think that he could turn down any of those.
Simon?
Yes.
I think I can answer that a little better, at least from my understanding of it. It seemed to me like the defense was saying that the prosecution really wanted to get rid of her because she was African-American, and the prosecution was saying, no, we want to get rid of her because she said that she couldn't sit in judgment of another person. So the prosecution saying they wanted to use their strike for because she said she couldn't sit in judgment of another, and the defense was saying they really wanted to get rid of her because she was African American.
That occurred to me, but I didn't want to say that since I didn't have the opportunity to hear what was said, because there are instances where lawyers, one way or another, may want to strike a jury on ethnicity reasons. I'll give an example. I've been using O.J. Simpson case as an example. One of the reasons they sued him civilly in Santa Monica is you get all white juries. And I joked with my wife that I don't know of a black man who's ever won a case in Santa Monica because of the nature of it. And with all due respect, downtown Los Angeles is primarily a minority jury pool. So at the end of the day, what happens is, you know, cases like O.J. Simpson's fare a great deal better because of that. So a lot of that may have to do with that. And by the way, that it is not sufficient grounds to strike a jury on race-related issues, ethnicity, and if anything, it's a violation of our Constitution, and the judge may well have been offended by it.
Well, she truly did say that she didn't think she would be able to sit in judgment of someone else, and so I just wasn't aware that they could use their strike and then have it taken away. I thought it was that's what they're there for.
Well,
so, but I'm thrilled with your show today, Simon. Thank you so much. This has been a very interesting process to me, seeing sort of what happens from beginning to end, and I really, truly hope she gets a fair trial. And I think everybody's doing everything they can to make sure of that, because I'd sure hate to see this happen another time. Well, I think it's a tremendous waste.
Well, thank you for calling in. Peter, I want to continue with the caller's question. Did you have any thoughts about that strike that didn't happen?
No, I'm learning as I go along in terms of what the process is there, and so it's new to me, and I think having Manny's explanation is very helpful. So at this point, I'm still listening and still learning and trying to understand what it is, for instance, that Jose Baez wouldn't want a deceptive person on the jury pool. I'm sorry, I just can't help but think that sometimes they may be discarding people that really think like Casey. And I wonder what goes on behind the thinking with that.
Manny, do you think that occasionally a juror tries to game the system? On Saturday morning, they managed to rattle through five jurors in 20 minutes. And essentially the get-out-of-jail card was, well, Your Honor, I do have an opinion. She's guilty. Next.
and that is a popular way of getting out of jury duty, and it'll be one as long as, you know, the world exists. It just is. But, you know, I want to come back to something that was just said about this being a new thing. Every time you appear before a judge in a jury trial, unless you've tried a case before them, before, it's a new thing. And they react differently in each case. And in the end of the day, you really don't know how an individual judge is going to act until you've been, appeared before them. And frequently, you can't tell how they're going to act on an individual issue. It's very, very hard to predict. So what you're seeing in this case, you may not see ever again because it may be so unique to the circumstances surrounding this case. And that's the nature of law, and that's what's hard for people to understand, is what I would describe as a constant lack of consistency from one courtroom to another. And it can go 10 feet to the next courtroom and be this inconsistent. So the thought is that for everybody, what you're seeing in this trial is unique. It is one of a kind. It's a wonderful, wonderful lesson. But please don't make it a rule for every case that you see in the future in your life, because you will not be able to really compare this very much with anything else you see except for the basic rules of engagement. And I hope that warning helps everybody when they evaluate things. The most important thing in law is be fluid. Law is a reflection of the social times, and it is not rigid, and you can assume that nothing that's going to happen will be similar to what happens in the next case. Thank you, Simon.
Oh, the defense rests.
I'm not defending anybody today.
Right.
Call me on Saturday morning when we're doing our health show, and then we'll get the other opinions.
Okay, and actually, that's a good segue. We're rapidly running out of time. Manny, you and I usually talk about other stuff. What do we do on Saturdays?
Well, on Saturdays, we do a health show called Surviving the 21st Century, which is just as hard to do health-wise as it is criminally. I'm a cancer survivor. I've written 4 books, It's Not Your Fault, Manny's Diet and Enzyme Formula, and we have a new one coming out called The Food Revolution Papers, and it's about how your food's being contaminated by the big food manufacturers and why cancer statistics and all this are rising. So if you'd like to learn a little bit about that, just please join us on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern.
And the name of your website?
Is howtoeliminatepain.com or mannysdietbook.com, either one. And, of course, our blogs frequently appear on Blogger News, so just go to Simon's site and type in Manny Barling and take a look at the articles. And, Simon, I think we have over 30 shows that people can download free on the iTunes store, right?
Yep, we do. We're busy critters.
No, you are.
I want to go once around the panel. Just to wrap up today's program. Dave, do you think it's reasonable, based on what we've seen this week, that this trial is actually going to last only 6 to 8 weeks?
Yeah, I think so, because it's not going to take an awful long time for the state to present its case. You know, I mean, they have so much evidence, and they have so much, so many witnesses, but if there's any delay, it's going to come from the defense, because it's their job to sit there and screw up whatever the state offers. But, I don't see it going any more than 2 months, and that includes the penalty phase.
Oh, Peter, 2 months, do you see it?
I'm always wrong, and that's what's right about me, Heather says. I'm with Dave on this one. It's going to be a brief trial, because with all the people that we have to present in terms of witnesses, there is very little substance of which the defense can present. And so I think the bigger question is the most ridiculous thing that Brad Conway said about Casey taking the stand in her own defense. That's really an interesting thing. But beyond that, I think point to point, it's going to move along a lot more quickly than we think.
Okay, I just have to mention this to our live listeners. We're about to lose our live feed, but fear not, folks. We will have the recording up and available very shortly after we finish. Jen, do you see this as being a 2-month trial?
Oh yeah, they're gonna drag it out. I'm not quite sure why they would want to. It seems to me like they would want to get it over with, but I'm sure that there's gonna be a lot of arguments in the courtroom.
Many. I mean, 2 months. Can they possibly get through this list of witnesses?
Oh, sure. First of all, most people just make a long witness list, and they don't really intend to call them anyway. They do it out of paranoia that if they don't include everybody, they can't call them later. And sometimes what one person says may obviate the need to call another as a witness. So don't let the witness list get to you. The real question is always, what's the judge going to put up with? I mean, just how much is the judge going to put up with from the defense attorneys? How long is he going to let them, you know, manipulate and delay? Because you are right that one of the main strategies of defense lawyers is to delay a case as much as they can, and they're going to try to.
Okay, and one other question. It's been announced that the jury is going to be sequestered. Whose advantage is that?
The hotels. Whoever gets the business.
No. If you think about it, it's an advantage to the defense because they're not the ones doing it. It's the, quote, government.
No, it usually works in the prosecution's favor because there's a tendency to rush through proceedings and rush judgment afterwards, and that always favors the one with the best case because people have less patience with opposition arguments, sort of like looking at 12 Angry Men where some people just want to go home. They think he's guilty, and they don't want to listen to you anymore. So, the bottom line is this case will be decided on the quality of the evidence. Right now, that seems to be leaning in the favor of the prosecution.
I guess we will find out next week or the week after. I really want to thank all of our listeners, and I especially want to thank our panel. It's been an interesting 90 minutes. And we will be back next Sunday. Who knows what we'll be talking about?
I have to add
suicide.
One thing.
We'll be talking about the suicide.
Thing. I have to add my final words. Don't forget, this is all for justice for Kaylee. She's the one that matters in all this.
Yep.
Okay.
And don't forget that the
Absolutely.
Suicide will hold this case up.
Right. Okay. Till next week, this is Simon and Jen Barrett wishing everyone a happy and safe weekend. We'll be back again soon.
Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you very much, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.